Welcome to season two of Blazing Trails. This Salesforce podcast is back for another season of stories we've collected from our events around the globe. I'm Marissa Kranis, Social and Content Marketing Lead for Salesforce Strategic Events. We're sharing stories that reach beyond the tech industry. So no matter your career, location, or interests, we aim to curate a podcast that speaks to you. You will hear from inspirational speakers and conversations around game-changing innovations. Learn about a breadth of topics from AI to the fourth industrial revolution to the fight for equal pay and so much more. Technology is moving fast, and as more and more companies join the fourth industrial revolution, they're looking more and more closely at the future of work. How is the data collected today in the apps we use shaping the future of business and society? Ginni Rometty, CEO of IBM, rarely sits down for interviews. But last year at Dreamforce, we were lucky enough to hear her speak in conversation with Mark Benioff, chairman and CEO of Salesforce. In their conversation about the future of work, they touch on many topics like the future of technology and its impact on business and society. Ginni and Mark also share their thoughts on how AI and other emerging technologies are challenging traditional business models while enabling Salesforce and IBM to help businesses make better decisions. Let's listen in.
And people ask me that question about IBM today, because they'll say, 106 years old, what is IBM? And I'll say, look, you know, one lesson is, to be 106, you have to be willing to change everything about yourself but your core values. And at its core, it's about innovating technology and applying it to business and society. It was true then, it's true today. And that's to me what was always kept me there. It was always ability to do something else, do another career, but within the same company. And it was always about, and it's why I went to IBM. While I could apply technology to cars, I really loved the technology. And so as an engineer, I started as an engineer.
When you think about those core values, and those core values are deep, but they're also very eternal for IBM, and they've influenced so many other companies, including ours. And there is a very deep commitment to society, like you mentioned, to the customer as well, on kind of improving the state of the world. This seems like it really came out of the founder's mission for IBM. Yeah, how do you look at that today?
Mark and I have talked about this topic quite a bit about values. And, you know, everybody has them. But it's a matter of, as people say with values, it's what you do when no one's looking, right, that matters on values. And our values are dedication to every client's success, innovation that matters for ourselves and for the world, and then trust and responsibility in all relationships. And I think one of the issues of today, data will be one of the issues of our time. And this responsibility, with so much discussion about how to treat data or artificial intelligence properly coming into the world, I link this discussion, you know, and that to me, there's some things that are very simple decisions you make when you have values about this. So when you said trust of clients, I think clients have trusted us with their most precious asset, which is their data, all right? And so I was just, before I was in Brazil last week in the European Union, and we had sort of put on paper something called data responsibility at IBM. And it was just to communicate what we've always believed. And I think in this day and age, this is a really important topic. And for your clients, our clients, we share together. We have 5,000 common clients that we work on together. That things like to say to you, your data is yours, not mine, to give away. If it's artificial intelligence, you own the insights. You own the algorithms. I'm the only one, I think, that can say that. If it's free flow of data, the IBM cloud was built so you decide what country the data sits in, not a government. Or if a government ever asked for access, we're the only tech that can say we've never given a government surveillance program access to that data. And that's wisdom of years of values, right? That you know, that you have trusted me with something. And so in this day and age, that idea, I think, is profound, and it's based on values. And I think for all of us, you and I know, Mark, you agree with me, things like AI, it is our job, we were talking with Bruno outside, to usher that safely into this world, right? I think those of us that make the technology, it is our job to be sure that it's ushered in the right way. And if I, can I go on a little bit more? You didn't ask me this question, but anyways. So what when I think about that topic, not just data, and we'll talk a little bit about AI, three things come to my mind. And we sort of published a set of principles that I would, if I was every client in the room, I think everyone to adopt. The first one is the purpose of AI in this world. It's why we called it cognitive, by the way. I know that is not a word that rolls off your tongue, but AI, artificial intelligence, has such negative connotation. This is to augment what everybody does. And therefore, the purpose is to augment, not replace man. I think the second principle, back to values, is transparency. For AI to thrive in this world, you need to tell people, this is the data that trained it, this is who trained it. You and I were talking, you can train bias if you're not careful. So this is the data, professionally who trained it, you own the insights, and then maybe later we'll talk about, and the world's gonna need different skills. And skills are gonna be a huge obligation of all of us, because every profession's gonna deal with this type. It'll be man and machine in everything. And so we gotta prepare a world for that. That's not a small thing. So that's all to me based on, if you live by values, you take a long arc at those kind of things.
So you talked about the changes in technology, in AI, advancements in this technology. You know, there's a lot of news stories right now about how some of these big tech companies, some of their technology got out of control. And maybe it's being used in some nefarious, you know, situations, especially as regards to the elections and politics. You know, we're, as you mentioned, you know, we're in this fourth industrial revolution. There's a lot of new technologies coming. Your company's working on so many of them, not just, you know, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, quantum is a huge effort for you. Nano, you know, you've been involved in the biotechnologies, CRISPR and so forth. You know, all of these technologies kind of fall in that category where, you know, these, you know, the technologies are not good or bad. It's how they get used. And we saw them used in, you know, some unexpected ways, you know. So how do you look at that?
Yeah, I think back to something I said, your job, my job, I think is we have to usher these technologies in with responsibility. So I don't think you can turn your back on any of that. And so, as I said, our views about data are what I said to you, right? That, you know, client owns the data, they own where it goes, no government access. I mean, AI, you own the insights. You have to live by those things. And so I think that's our job with all of these. And by the way, some of these technologies coming out, Mark mentioned quantum, blockchain, we can talk about some of these in simple terms. But quantum's an interesting one, because on one hand, quantum can solve problems that normal computers can't. It, you know, in the way, an easy way to think of it is, normal computers have zeros and ones, they're on or off. Quantum, it has almost infinite, it can be infinite things at one time. That sounds weird, but you gotta be a quantum scientist. So the difference is, you could give it a problem that today, if you put it in a traditional, even supercomputer, high performance, it would run forever and never finish. And that's true with like systemic risk. They can kind of paper estimate, they can't truly model. So quantum will be used, first thing it'll be used for is things like drug discovery, material science. Things that today they have to kind of approximate, but now you could actually model it, and it would, the model would finish and you get an answer versus infinite time. And we, by the way, are the only one that have a 17 qubit already out on the cloud. You can go get it on the IBM cloud. People have to start to play with this and understand it. Now, that said, and the next things, by the way, for those of you in logistics or those of you that do financial risk modeling, that'll be the next stuff for quantum. The reason I used it as an example of this is, there's also a dark side of quantum. Within several years, quantum can be used to break almost all forms of encryption. So while we are working on building it, we are also working on the anecdote, which is, because no way should we unleash something like that in the world without something to address that. And so we are addressing the technology, I won't say what it is because the guys have done pretty darn good on it, that will then be used as the anecdote that can stop that from happening. So I think you have to think about that with everything you do. What's its purpose? And you know, I have this conversation with my own teams all the time. If something they want to do with one of our technologies, I'm like, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And so that is my viewpoint on this. You have to take responsibility. So that's, I'll leave it at, thank you, I'll leave it at that. You like that? You agree?
I absolutely agree. I want to ask you, I want to continue down that track. That, you know, 36 years at IBM, you just went through an incredible scenario on quantum computing, but you also hit a number of technology areas and accelerations. It feels like there's, you know, you have a broad view on all these technologies because IBM sees and is working on so much through the technology industry and has, you know, since its beginning. Is this a broad acceleration in technology? Do you think that this things are going faster than ever before, or is that just how it appears?
I think they are going faster than ever before. How many people feel like that? Do you feel like they are? The same. It is not only because you feel it. Your feeling is real, and if you go back in time, most of technology. As technology, there'd be one major technology happening at a time, and then it would cause a bump and another. Now they're one after another, and their speed, right? And so that's quite accurate. And again, back to what we are, and we'll talk about our partnership maybe a little bit too. You know, our job is about, I hope, transforming an enterprise. And so I was talking to Mark earlier. I said, you know, one of the most important things I think for all of us is to know thyself, know what you are. And for us, it's business. We are not a consumer company. We work through you to consumers, but we support you. And to these number of technologies, I was going to name some of the most interesting ones, I think, in front of us. So we built what we think is a platform for business, the IBM Cloud in Watson. And if you're for business, you're different than for consumer, we believe. So as an example, data. Got to care about where it is and how it's taken care of. Secure to the core. If it's AI, AI is different for consumer than enterprise, business. An example, for business, for artificial intelligence, you care about medicine, underwriting, financial, sales, an engineer of oil, petroleum. That kind of AI has to know a vertical. It has to be able to learn off of small amounts of data that are very deep, regulatory. It's not like there's a billion conversations on the web about the regulatory environment. So you have to learn off of a very different way. So we built AI for business, and that's the root of our partnership between Einstein and Watson, him understanding him, Watson. Watson was our founder. He was a him, so I call it a him. That you understand verticals. So these technologies, the reason they can come faster, we're going to keep putting them on the cloud. So AI, Watson, on the cloud, AI for business. The next one, you're going to see quantum. Now here already is blockchain. And so we're doing some work together with many of you that put Salesforce blockchain together, Salesforce AI together. And again, these are some technologies. You know, I think of blockchain, my kind of real quick sort of tutorial on it, is blockchain will do for trusted transactions, what the internet did for information. Meaning you could change transactions between people who do not like each other. They do not trust each other. They don't need to, done properly. And there's so much waste in the world. One of my, we have a bunch of 500 blockchain projects now. One going on is on food safety. So back to that, these technologies will solve problems the world can't solve. $100 billion of food is wasted a year for food safety, right? I mean, you hear that, like, bad spinach. Okay, everybody takes all the spinach and throws it out. It's not all bad. So this started work we did with Walmart, and now we've got 20 of the world's largest food producers all working on food safety. And it's easy on a blockchain, because these can ride alongside your current systems. You throw off the same transaction, and we can now, we started with pork and mangoes. You know, it took 7 days to trace where he came from, farm to fork kind of thing. We're down to, you know, 7 seconds on this. And we'll solve a really big issue. There are a lot of people that die from food poisoning and food safety issues. So that to me, you say, is it coming faster? Yeah, because just think, I went through cloud to AI to quantum to blockchain, but always about how to apply it to what everybody here does.
My comment before, which is you've worked with so many people now in your career, not just at IBM, but around the world, and you've seen this, you know, lots of people, you know, struggling with success and failure and rising up. Here you are, the CEO of one of the largest and most important companies in the world. What do you think the difference is for people along the way, you know, multiple decades, 4 decades, you know, Why is it that some people succeed and then some people drop off? What is your view on that?
That's a good question, and I have a couple views on it. And it's funny, when Mark asked that, like some things jump in my head, and that's probably the answer to it. And there was a quote from, it was Ann Richards, she was the governor of Texas. And she said, oh, Texans are here, okay. And but someone said to her, what's the secret to your success? And she said, it's passion and perseverance when everyone else would have given up. And there's so much to be said for that. Yeah. And again, I'm gonna remember, I think I will remember this right, if it was Thomas Edison, who said, many of life's failures are people who gave up right before they were going to be successful. And so I think so much of what we all do is really about that, right? A, you gotta be passionate, right? I mean, so that's when I moved from cars to IT, I had to be passionate about what I do. Life's too short, right? You gotta be passionate about it. And I think that you can choose your disposition, right? You can choose to see a way through. And I would only add one other point to it, which is why do I think some people succeed and others don't? I'll tell a story I have told many times, I'll preface that. But it was from my own husband, and I think this is the root as well to why do people succeed or not. I was early in my career, maybe, have I told you that story? I don't even remember. 10 years or so in, and I had gotten a boss, a very good man who I was working for, and he said, I'm gonna get a new job, and I think you should take my job. And I said, oof, I don't think I'm ready for this. And he said, well, you gotta go to the interview, and I went to the interview, and the man said to me, you know, I want you to take the job. And I said, I don't think I'm ready for it. I don't know, I need to go home. I wanna think about it, and I wanna talk to my husband. He looked at me, and said, okay. I went home that night, same husband I still have, by the way, all these years. I wouldn't even say husband, people are like, which one or something, you know, same one. And he sits there and he's listening to me like he still to this day does, like this. And he looked at me and he said, do you think a man would have answered it that way? I said, no. I went back in the next day and I took the job. And he looked at me and he said, don't do that again. I said, I understand. But the story taught me something so much more profound, which I have repeated endlessly, and it's the other answer to Mark's question, which is, I would say growth and comfort, they will never coexist. And so you have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I find it particularly true for many women, but it's true for men too. If I asked you to shut your eyes, as I say, if you are not already sleeping, and say, you know, when did you grow the most in your career? And I will ask you, did you feel at risk? I mean, almost I bat 100% on this question. People will say yes. And I say it's true for people, it's true for companies, and I think it's true for countries. And it's a profound, simple thought, but it can make you, when you say, how do you keep going? It will make you take risks, and it'll make you feel, like even now, if I'm not getting nervous, I'm like, oh, something's wrong. I am not learning enough then, because you're not. So I almost, it's a very good tool, I think, for anybody to go be a risk taker, because you know out the other end comes something really good.
The other side of the future of work is culture. Company culture is shaping much more than employee happiness. The responsibility of companies to implement fair, equal, and prosperous company culture and ethics affects the next generation of workers, as well as workers today. Cindy Robbins, Chief Executive of Employee Success at Salesforce, spoke at the Fortune CEO Initiative this year in partnership with Salesforce. She dives into how she helped to start the equal pay movement at Salesforce.
Let me start with equal pay, because that really also helped define me as an executive and as a leader at Salesforce in many ways. It started about four and a half years ago. Our CEO, Mark Benioff, does these quarterly operational reviews with the top executives who own a lot of the business plan objectives for the year. And he looked around the room one day and realized there were hardly any women in the room. And he knew these women existed in the company, but we weren't doing a good job of really giving them visibility and giving them a seat at the table. So he decided to do that. And going forward, he mandated that 30% of that room going forward would be made up of women. high potential women, women that we knew were going to elevate into big jobs in the company. I benefited from that. He opened a door for me and my good friend and colleague, Layla Seca, who's a product executive at the time. And her and I go back 20 plus years in friendship. And so we got a door open for us and we got a seat at the table. And our job was to stay invited to these meetings. That was our accountability. And so we did. And we both elevated about the same period of time. And then we started putting our heads together around things that we wanted to do to really elevate more women in the company. Why wasn't this easier? What could we do as women executives in the company? So Layla and I put our heads together. Pay was one of them. A woman in the company, several layers down, also had a great idea about a women's summit at Dreamforce. And she needed Mark's sign-off. And she tried to find her path to get there. And she knew Layla. Layla knew Cindy. Cindy reported to Mark. Mark was a decision maker. So she found her journey. We took that up to Mark and also parental leave and some other great programs. And so he said on pay, I think he was a little confused. He said, do we have a problem? Have we done the assessment? And I said, we haven't done the assessment. We've never done this type of assessment. But I do know we can't do it. See a big dollar sign and kind of shut the hood. We can't do that. And if we do it, we're doing this every single year. I think that's the one thing that really surprises people that I talk to. I always get the question, well, why do you keep doing it? And why do you have to keep paying? And it's still a journey for us. It's the easy part was asking him. The hard thing is actually doing it. And when you're talking about 30,000 people and their pay, you have to make sure you take a thoughtful approach and you do it right. And there's always going to be rooms for some error. You're going to have a year where you acquire 14 companies, for example, and you acquire their technology and their people and their pay practices, and you have to incorporate that into Salesforce's pay practices. So there's a lot around that, but I do feel that also shifted us on our stance on equality because equal pay is part of the DNA of our culture now. It's part of equality. You know, shortly after that, we hired Tony Proffitt, our chief equality officer. And he's done an amazing job, you know, really making this really, truly part of our practices and our behavior. And a lot of it is around data, right? There is power in data alone. And I've learned how to do that and how it applies to the culture. I always say Salesforce is kind of, our culture is dictated by our values, not by perks. And I firmly believe that.
Will AI create a whole new reality for the future of work? What lies at the intersection of humans and machines? How is AI changing the very nature of work and business processes? There is a missing middle on jobs and skills, and understanding the missing middle means opening doors to incredible value for business. A plethora of discussion and debate surrounds the subject of the job displacement AI will bring. But will AI also create entirely new categories of human jobs? The phenomenal promise and opportunity of AI also demands responsibility like never before. What can we do now to prepare for these challenges and truly turn AI into society's secret weapon for growth? At Dreamforce 17, Paul Doherty, Chief Technology and Innovation Officer at Accenture, dove into these topics with the latest emerging thinking and insights.
So let me start with a couple of questions, though. How many of you are getting the idea that artificial intelligence might be something important that we need to pay attention to? Show of hands. Okay, a lot of people raise their hands. And how many of you feel like you understand what to do in your company or your organization and how to go about applying artificial intelligence? Show of hands. So not so many, a couple, but not so many. And that's really what I'm going to try to talk about a little bit today, because we're at the early stages of a trailblazing revolution here with artificial intelligence. And we talk a lot about what we fear with AI and things we see right now, but it's hard to chart your course and think about how you apply AI to transform your organization. So I'll talk about that a little bit. And this is based on research that we've been doing at Accenture to look at thousands of companies, some clients we work with and other companies, and look at what we're seeing with the early adoption patterns with artificial intelligence. Look at what the leaders are doing and those that are applying it now. And we've done this research and we've used this to project out what we believe the route to success, the pathways to success are going to be to apply artificial intelligence in the right way to your business. And I'll tell you that there's three things that we found out in doing this that I'll talk about during the course of the presentation, but I'll summarize it right now for you. The first thing is that AI will radically transform business. And we firmly believe that. I'm guessing most of you would agree with that already based on what you're hearing. But the transformation is going to be big. We believe this is the biggest single transformation of the information age. And with things like the fourth industrial revolution that we talk about, it is indeed that big, another step in a major revolution. So it's a radical transformation of business. Second point is that this is going to create jobs. Which is a very controversial point right now when you look at the literature. It is indeed going to create jobs, but it's not going to create the jobs you think it might. And we'll talk about the kinds of jobs that we see being created as all of our organizations deploy artificial intelligence and the kind of jobs that will be needed. And the third key point is that we strongly believe that AI has the power to really to make what we do as employees, as executives, as workers, and as consumers more human. The power and the potential of artificial intelligence, conversely, allows us to be more human in what we do and to treat people more, in a more human fashion. And that's the other thing that I'll talk about over the course of this talk here. And we're writing a book on this also. I'll summarize that at the end and show you what that's going to look like. But we're writing a book to talk about this, which is called Human Plus Machine, Reimagining Work in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. And that idea of reimagining work is what I'm going to talk about here a bit in the talk. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's think about work and the kind of work that our organizations do. Just step back and imagine we're not in this nice room in Dreamforce in the conference center here. Imagine you're working in the back office of a bank in a compliance function. Let's say you're working in the anti-money laundering division of a bank. A large bank will have 5,000, 10,000 people or more working in anti-money laundering compliance. Cubicles after cubicle after cubicle, rows of people. And what are they doing? They're looking at reports that are and transactions that are flagged that they have to go investigate, look at the transaction, decide if there's been a violation of money laundering rules. Turns out it's a very imperfect process. Those thousands and thousands of people spend almost all their time chasing false leads, which is very frustrating. They go and do the analysis, chart, you know, follow it down a long way, and they realize, okay, no problem here, move on to the next one. It's dull, tedious work, unfulfilling, because you're not leveraging your creativity and finding the problems. You know, contrast that with a new way of doing that process, which is applying machine learning to better understand the patterns. Have machine learning work alongside the employees, they can learn the right patterns to be looking for and use other data to extrapolate the patterns so that the false positives are reduced to a very low level. And instead of getting flags of lots of false positives that need to be looked at, the workers are spending their energy and creativity doing things they like to do, tracking down real issues, real violations, and using their creativity, their investigative powers to find real illicit activity. That's how AI is being applied now in the financial services industry to transform the way that people work in a very profound way. Or picture yourself, if you don't want to be in a cubicle, picture yourself out in the oil business, operating a rig. And think about the current way that you might operate the rig. Tens of thousands of data points and sensors, physical, mechanical sensors and such, that you're trying to, as an operator or a maintenance engineer, you're trying to understand what's happening, visualize it, use your expertise to decide what to do. Think about a different process using 3D visualization, gaming engines, artificial intelligence, augmented reality, to instead put you as the maintenance engineer or operator in the heart of the drill, see it in real time as if you were down in the ground watching the progress of the drill, and then using digital twin AI technologies to predict what might happen and run what-if scenarios to better operate the drill, better maintain the drill, you know, better reliability, better output. That's what an AI-enabled process looks like in the drilling industry. So think about those two examples. Whether you're in a cubicle or you're operating equipment, the work dramatically changes. And we talk about, in the book we're doing and the work we're doing at Accenture, we talk about this idea that we're approaching a third generation of work, a third generation of business processes and how they work. The first generation of work was, think about this, assembly lines over a century ago. Henry Ford, Frederick Taylor, scientific management, time-based performance. It was taking physical labor and augmenting our hands in terms of what we could do. And that was the first generation of real industrialized work. The second generation of work was the latter half of the last century with information work, the information age. We talked about re-engineering the corporation. Still largely sequential processes, and we didn't really empower people too much in those cases. We instead defined static processes and offloaded some things to computers and defined very precisely the role of people in these in processes and often locked people into very static and flexible processes. And we believe in that we're now entering the need for a third generation of work in business processes and really rethinking the way we approach defining our organizations. And in this third generation, it's much different. Think about the examples I just talked about. Rather than static, inflexible, linear processes, think adaptive, virtuous circles of activity happening, event-driven, adaptive and dynamic based on real-time conditions. And that's the nature of the transformation of work that we're seeing and the nature of the big transformation that we think about when we talk about this idea of reimagining work and reimagining business in the age of AI.
This podcast is brought to you by Dropbox. Dropbox is a leading global collaboration platform that's transforming the way people and teams work together. As a strategic partner, Dropbox is working with Salesforce to reimagine the work experience, building new solutions that eliminate disruption and help teams collaborate across sales, service, marketing, commerce, and more. Learn more at Dropbox.com. Next time on Blazing Trails, we're bringing you an exclusive interview with Julie Legal, Salesforce's SVP of Strategic Events. Hear about Julie's inspiring career, some of her favorite Salesforce memories, and of course, her experience running the world's most innovative tech conference, Dreamforce. Join us for this conversation with one of Salesforce's most inspiring female leaders. Thank you again for joining us on Blazing Trails. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And keep up with exclusive content from trailblazers around the world.